BFFT. From the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
One of the strengths of this radio program over 17 years or so is the Rolodex we've developed. And I am proud to say our next guest is a terrific addition to the rotation of guests that I like to work in during college football season. Chip Towers has been covering Georgia Bulldogs football and Georgia Bulldogs athletic programs for years for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We got to know him a little bit when Oregon hired Dan Lanning. We got to know him even better when Georgia played Oregon and Dan Lanning. Never mind what happened after kickoff. If they played again, would it be a better game? Could it be worse? I talked to Chip Towers at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. I settled in. I turned on my laptop. The game kicked off, and then it was over. Just like that. Chip Towers joining us from the great state of Georgia. How are you, man?
John, it is so nice to hear from you. And yeah, that does seem like ancient history, doesn't it? I feel like I can say with a good bit of conviction, should they play again, and let's verbalize it into the universe right now. I hope they do this year. I don't think it would be 49-3 anybody, for sure. I think it would be a much better game. It looks like your Ducks are loaded for bear out there, I guess you'd say. And Georgia's still doing what Georgia has been doing under Kirby Smart, even after his, good pal and protege, Dan Lanning left the scene here. So, really, really excited what I've seen and read about Oregon. And I'm just coming a couple hours removed from Georgia's sixth preseason camp practice. And there's nothing I saw there that told me that this number one preseason prediction by USA Today coaches can't be realized. And I expect the same preseason ranking to come out when the Associated Press releases its poll in the next few days or week or so.
Georgia at number one in the coaches poll. Chip Towers with us, covers Georgia. You know, Chip, I look at Oregon at number three in that same poll, and I think a lot has changed for Dan Lanning in a couple years. Remember after that Georgia-Oregon game, Kirby Smart made the comment, hey, I've got better players. Dan needs better players. People freaked out about it, but there was truth in that, and Oregon has recruited really well, but how is that going over in the Georgia footprint or in SEC territory as people kind of look at what Lanning has done at Oregon with the portal and with all the tools that Phil Knight has given him?
Well, I'll tell you this right now. They're glad that Oregon is located where it is geographically and that Dan Lanning hasn't chosen an address closer to the University of Georgia, because he certainly could have. And you know, between Kirby Smart and Dan Lanning, there is nothing but the ultimate professional respect. And so, you know, these guys, you know, aren't much for propaganda and that kind of thing. And, you know, looking at it in hindsight, because there's all the pregame rhetoric, right? And you and I were both excited about that as a season opener. Actually, Georgia is going to be back in Mercedes-Benz Stadium on August 31st playing Clemson this time. And, you know, those are great, right? Regional, non-regional games, I mean, non-regional opponents coming together. And then you had all the different storylines, you know, with Lanning coming from Georgia and all that. But at the end of the day, these guys, they know what they have. You know, they know what they have. And in retrospect, I think Kirby went in there and pretty confident, and Dan went in there probably without a lot of confidence. Behind the scene, he's never going to exude that. It's not part of his personality, and you want to get everything you can out of your team, and you never know what's going to happen in football, probably as much as any sport. But, you know, I think Dan Lanning heeded Kirby Smart's assessment and went out and got some better players. I mean, I think that's what's happened. It's nothing fancy. You know, they kind of run very similar systems. You know, both at University of Georgia and University of Oregon, you have every resource at your disposal. Thanks to the NCAA and changes in the last several years, everything's above board now. So, you know, Phil Knight's still Phil Knight, and, you know, Georgia fans are still nuts about football and their team. So everybody's ponying up and, you know, doing what they can to bring the best players to the respective campuses. And when you look at the top five now, I think it reflects that. I mean, we can go as down in the weeds as you want to. I like to stay above them myself, but, you know, I think, unfortunately, this is kind of what we're going to see in college football. The haves are going to keep having, and they're going to keep getting. And right now, Oregon and Georgia are both haves. Texas is a have. Ohio State is a have. And, you know, they are going to be in the hunt this year. Fortunately, we get to see 12 teams make the cut, and then it might get real interesting after that, but maybe not all that interesting before then.
How do you think that expansion to 12 teams is going to change the postseason?
Well, my most profound, I started to say concern, but it's not really a concern. It's more of a interest in seeing is, you know, how it affects championship games. Now, you know, we've heard all the rhetoric and all the commissioners and all them saying that, oh, this, you know, the championship game is still going to be as important as it always was. But is it really, right? I mean, if you know you're in, what about Georgia last year? You know, would they play Carson Beck, you know, in the SEC championship game and just take their chances on going with the backup quarterback and some backups here and there? And heck, you know, the league is going to want as many to get in anyway. So I don't know. I'm a skeptic by trade, and, you know, so we'll see what happens with those. I like the skin in the game factors that they say they're going to use in determining these 12, but, you know, we'll see. We got to get there, and I think it's going to make the postseason more exciting, and I think we'll see how it affects the regular season.
You know, the Oregon for a time spent a lot of time looking over at maybe Washington or USC, not so much this year, but now it looks like they're looking at Ohio State because they play them. Who's Georgia thinking about as the season or fall camp, you know, sort of unfolds?
Well, the funny thing that has happened in, you know, really in the Kirby Smart era, has been the Alabama thing. I mean, I think it's always Alabama. Georgia's success aside, Kirby still struggled like heck with Nick Saban, like everybody else in this league did. So there's nobody probably more pleased behind the scene than the Kirby Smart family to see that man finally retire. And he's, you know, he still has an effect over there. But Kirby Smart was 1-5 against Saban. And so, but those were great games. There were never really any blowouts. Georgia obviously beat them in the biggest game for the national championship. They lost in the national championship game. They lost SEC championships, I think, every time they met. So, so Alabama's hanging there, and they got them on the schedule. It's weird the way the new, you know, SEC schedule came out. And, you know, the last time Georgia played Alabama in a regular season, they went to Tuscaloosa. Well, lo and behold, they're going to Tuscaloosa again. You know, there's so much conspiracy theory around here about, you know, Alabama runs the SEC over there in Birmingham. from afar. And so they got to go. Georgia has to go to Alabama. But there's also a massive amount of intrigue for Texas. You know, Georgia making the first trip there since 1960, playing them for the first time since, well, they played in the Sugar Bowl, but they hadn't played. This will be only the second time ever they played in the city of Austin. There also happens to be a Formula F1 race that weekend, so I'm still figuring out where I'm going to stay and exactly how I'm going to get there that particular weekend. That's crazy. And Georgia has to go to the road, against Ole Miss and in Kentucky, too. So, you know, it feels a little bit like an NFL schedule in terms of how, you know, the SEC/NFL junior turned out these 2024 schedules. Georgia's got the toughest schedule in the league. But they're not whining about it. You know, at the SEC Media Days, which were held in Dallas this year, you know, Kirby and the Bulldogs basically said, bring it on. You know, to be the best, you got to beat the best and all that kind of stuff. And because of the 12-team playoff, I think there is room for error, unlike it certainly was in the BCS era.
Chip Towers, Atlanta Journal-Constitution with us, covers Georgia. You've got Texas in the SEC, and you have Kalen DeBoer now instead of Nick Saban at Alabama. Can you unpack those two things a little bit? Like, you know, I think during media days there was an awful lot of talk about Texas. And some of the teams, I don't know if Georgia was, but some of the teams were annoyed by that. Like, you know, Texas coming in and why is everybody talking about Texas? And then this shift from Saban to DeBoer. What happens at Alabama with that new regime?
Well, you know, it was what made it truly interesting for me, and I think everybody else, was just Saban's presence there. You know, it's like most of the time when a guy leaves and retires, you don't see him. But, you know, he had more airtime than anybody. And it wasn't just the airtime. If you were there attending, the proceedings at the Omni Hotel in downtown Dallas, I mean, Saban was everywhere. You know, when he wasn't, you know, on the set and on TV with the SEC Network, he was doing this radio over here and this satellite show over here and this show over there. So, yeah, if you wanted something from Saban, you could just walk up and ask him about it. So that was kind of interesting. And I think, you know, Kalen DeBoer's got to feel that a little bit. Now, he's no dummy. I mean, he's embraced it. And my understanding is, Nick Saban has been around in an advocate capacity, whatever that is. I mean, I don't know. I don't cover Alabama, and you know, we'll see. The other interesting part of it is, you know, just, you know, you don't know what's truth and fiction, but, you know, they just, you know, reading the Alabama, Twitter feed, X feed, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, about, you know, they're playing music now, or this is not how Saban did it. This is something you'd never see at a Saban practice. And, but look, you know, they're still loaded with great players. You know, I mean, if you look at the last five recruiting classes, which are, you know, mostly comprise what that roster is, they're all great. They're, you know, right there hand in hand with Georgia. Kalen DeBoer clearly knows what to do with good players. Heck, he knows what to do with players that maybe aren't as good. I mean, he's a good coach. It's not smoke and mirrors. Now, he's a long way from his comfort zone, and, you know, we'll see how all that translates eventually, but they have good players over there. And, but there's, you know, there's a very healthy dose of skepticism, about an outsider being able to come in and be there. And again, I don't mean to turn this back to Dan Lane, but I know a lot of Georgia fans, probably, you know, exhaled relief when Dan Lanning, I don't know how deep it got. I didn't cover it that close like I did when Oregon was talking to Lanning. But I don't know how far down the road they got that. But I know that would have been a huge hire for Alabama. And I know Oregon, the big win for Phil Knight and the Oregon Ducks to keep him out there.
Chip Towers with us, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. All right, you've watched Kirby Smart take over at Georgia. He went 8-5 his first season, and then it really clicked for him. 13-2, got to the national title game. Then it's just been 11-3 and 12-2, and skipped the pandemic year. 14-1, 15-0, 13-1. You watched him turn a corner. What happened in that first season that set Kirby Smart up, do you think, to really soar in season two and beyond?
Well, it's up front. Look, you know, that's it's really not that fancy. And there's a lot of things that are different about football nowadays. But one thing hasn't changed is you got to win up front. And Kirby Smart called that when he first showed up in 2016. You know, sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes the front, he said, man, we got to get bigger. He came from Alabama where, you know, everybody's, you know, 6'4", 6'5", across the line, you know, 300-plus pounds. We got to get – he didn't see enough of those kind of dudes at Georgia. I'm sitting here right before you called watching a commitment video of a guy that chose Georgia. And this guy is just typical of what you've seen under Kirby Smart. He's an offensive lineman from the city of Atlanta. He's 6'8", 340 pounds. You know, they just brought in a 6'10", you know, I don't know if you read about this, but a basketball player, you know, who was playing out there in California and just changed his mind, decided he wanted to play football. And Georgia was there to scoop him up. He's on campus in the class of 24, and they're trying to make a football player. I mean, very athletic, 6'10", 40 or 50 pound guy. You know, he's very athletic from what I've seen of him in practice. But this guy Juan Gaston's coming in. That's the case. That's the case again this year. You know, if you look at across the fronts, Georgia hasn't been quite as dominant on the defensive line. I mean, those are players everybody's fighting over in the trenches, tooth and nail right now, NIL, everything else. But offensive line, Georgia's loaded again. All those guys across the front, they got 3 fifth-year seniors over there. You know, they're actually talking. They've been able to talk some guys into coming back and foregoing the NFL for another year to pursue, you know, college championships. And between that and, you know, Carson Beck and getting Trevor Etienne to come in, Georgia's playing a lot more in the transfer portal now. Not necessarily to the degree that Dan is or a lot of other people, but, I mean, I think they got 11 through the transfer portal this year, including Ben Jurasek out of Stanford, an all Pac-12 tight end. Colby Young, an all ACC wide receiver out of Miami. They're playing a little bit more in the free agency game, I guess you'd call it nowadays. And as you alluded to, if you count the COVID years, I mean, think about it. Wrap your head around this, John. Georgia has won 47 of its last 49 games. Two losses going back into the COVID season because they didn't lose toward the end of it and didn't get a chance to play for a national championship that year. But, you know, I mean, it's pretty incredible what they've been able to do during this current run.
Let me ask you this, because you kind of talked about the portal, and Dan Lanning is – pushed back against the narrative that, you know, they're just buying players or they have an unlimited war chest and all that. But how is Oregon's talent acquisition going over in the SEC footprint? How are people there viewing that part of the Oregon operation?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the talk here, and you might be able to speak a little to this, John. I thought about giving you a call and haven't had an opportunity to, but there's kind of some sort of, Southern Cal, Georgia thing going on. I don't know if you've noticed this, you know, but they've ended up grappling over a few players. You know, obviously Southern Cal got Bear Alexander a few years ago, and Georgia has, snatched up Michael Jackson III from Southern Cal through the transfer portal and have gone head-to-head on a couple of guys that Georgia's won on here lately. But, you know, it's been interesting. I'm sure you saw the banter between Dan and Kirby said something, I guess it was at SEC Media Days, about, having that Oregon money, Dan having that Oregon money. And then, and then Dan says, hey, you know, it's not like Kirby hadn't been able to check the recruiting range, you know, check and see what he's been doing. So it's not like, you know, he's over there in the soup line. And, you know, and it's true. I mean, you know, the free agent market is what it is now, and you're either in it or not. Now, one thing I think Kirby Smart has done especially well, fan bases are all different. You know, the Texas schools, they're going to have a giant war chest. You know, there's certain schools and certain fan bases, you know, that are going to probably have a deeper pool than maybe Georgia does, or some other people. But Georgia, it's about passion. There's a lot of a lot in terms of number of alumni, very passionate about their base. But Kirby, I think, does a good job of selling that it ain't all about the money. We're here to get you the big money later, not the little money now. Come here. He has a very socialistic system, as I understand it. Now, getting real information with real veracity and truthfulness about NIL is impossible. That's the reason all these coaches want, you know, some kind of new system to sort of monitor everything. So getting a straight answer about that is really hard. But Georgia seems to have a pretty good sort of socialistic structure. If you're a starter here, this is what the pay is. You know, if you're a regular here, this is what the pay is. If you're a walk-on or backup, this is what you get through our collective and through NIL. Anything you earn over that is up to you. And so guys like Carson Beck, you know, is driving a $273,000 Lamborghini. You know, Texas is apparently giving them away like cotton candy when you sign there. I don't know what Oregon's doing. I haven't been following it close enough, but, you know, at least they're going to get a nice pair of shoes, I'm sure. Maybe a little, you know, wardrobe. But that's where we're at. And I think Kirby's done a pretty decent job of walking that fine line between development and, you know, early reward. He's doing a pretty good job of that right now.
Chip Towers, I would love to catch back up with you maybe in the middle of the season or after they've played some games, but keep doing what you're doing, man. Do a fantastic job, and, you know, maybe I'll see you during the playoff if Oregon or one of these other teams goes far enough to get in a game with Georgia.
I truly hope so, John. And you got to clear me up on this now. I mean, are you still my Pac-12 expert, or is it Pac-2, or kind of – are you a Big Ten guy now? I mean, I don't know how to process this.
I've got them all covered. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm covering all the teams that I covered before. So you have a question about the Big Ten teams from the Pacific time zone, I'm your guy. And if you have a question about the Pac-12, I'm your guy. And if you have a question about Grandma's Italian spaghetti sauce, I'm your guy for that too.
All right. I'm good for all. I could call you with all of those.
Chip Towers, thank you, man.
Thanks, pal.
There he goes from the great state of Georgia. I love checking in with him. That's the number one team in the coaches poll. We'll get number two, Ohio State, in the 5 o'clock hour. I hope you're here for it.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750, The Game.
So Dan Lanning's had to come out a couple of times and try to combat the narrative that Oregon's got this war chest that is unlimited in resources. It's going to come up frequently. It has come up a number of times. I want to deal with this just a little bit right now and talk about this. So he had to come out and talk about how Oregon has adapted to the NIL space. He's had to come out and basically say, no, we don't have an unlimited war chest, because the perception is that Oregon's got more money than anybody. And, you know, you have unlimited resources because of Phil Knight. And you know, I get why he's pushing back a little bit on this. And I posted a clip of Lanning from our interview from Big Ten Media Day on my Twitter and on my Instagram and TikTok. And if you want to hear it, it's Lanning essentially saying, hey, it's like a disservice to my coaches and the work they've put in to just say we're buying players or whatnot. But the truth is, like, isn't the perception the reality here? Isn't the authentic truth to the Oregon story that this ecosystem and college athletics has pivoted in a way that benefits Oregon more than anybody? And it's a blessing that they've got a donor, because any school would want to have Phil Knight spending $1 billion, pouring $1 billion into his alma mater. Any school out there would want to have that, but it's not just the $1 billion. It's the relationship with Nike. It's his ideas. As one longtime University of Oregon donor, told me of Phil Knight. Phil Knight has the ability to see around a corner. He's got vision. And isn't that a blessing? Because meanwhile, Kirby Smart's at SEC Media Day, and he's fueling the narrative.
This year, we took Nike, who I've had the great pleasure of meeting Phil Knight and his wonderful wife, Penny, and I wish I could get some of that NIL money that he's sharing with Dan Lanning, but that's another note.
You know, that narrative is out there, and it's not going away. So Dan Lanning, on one hand, can say, hey, you know, that does a real disservice to my coaching staff who's working hard, going to like 300 high schools on recruiting visits and all the camps we run and the scouting we do. Because it's true, like when, you know, when everybody says, well, you just have more resources, it does kind of become an insult to your coaching staff. But on the other hand, I kind of like to see it this way. I think anybody would take the advantage that Oregon has with Phil Knight. And I think the question now is, can Dan Lanning and his coaching staff take the tools that Phil Knight has given them, and can they put them to work in a way that puts Oregon over the top? And, you know, Lanning's talking a little bit about how NIL and how Oregon's adapted, and listen here.
Yeah, I think it's two things. One, you got to have players that want to be here, right? So you have to create an environment that they enjoy being a part of. And then two, you have to make sure that they're taken care of and they're able to create opportunities for themselves. And when I think about why I came to Oregon in the first place, you know, this place has always been on the cutting edge, mm-hmm. innovative, never felt like they were operating from behind. They've made a decision to be, you know, ahead of the curve. So when that became part of the landscape of college football, I feel like they made the decision, okay, let's figure out how we can do this better than anybody else. And you have to right now to compete at this level.
And I think, you know, I can remember when a time when Oregon felt like it was competing from behind, and it's only become, I think, in the last decade or so where you watched Oregon kind of surge. And, you know, it was like there was a conscious effort there, and it was fueled absolutely by facilities and by money. And now that you can pay players directly from the school and you have NIL involved, absolutely that's an advantage. Embrace it if you're Oregon. Steven, what's the allergy to just saying, yeah, we've got Phil Knight, it's a tremendous advantage. Now it's our job as a coaching staff to go out and maximize that.
Well, I feel like the thing about it is it's the view from the outside, from the people that aren't necessarily in it, and they feel like that they're, and we talked about this earlier this week, just about how fans will only see the good in their programs. And so when Oregon does something, every other fan base is going to say, well, it's because of Nike. And when someone in the SEC does something, it's because, well, they're cheating and everything like that. So I think it's just, that's Oregon's Achilles heel, is that their cheating is known as Nike. Where other schools, we just say, oh, they were cheating, or they were, you know, that before you could pay NIL, they were paying players, that type of thing. I think it shows, you don't want to prove that Oregon is actually on the same level as an Alabama or a Georgia. And it's easier to say, oh, well, you guys would be nothing without Nike and without Phil Knight. So you guys don't really belong at the same table as we are.
I've always just felt like, I guess people have held that up as an insult. Like, you know, I got here in December of 2002. So I've been here long enough to kind of look around and go, okay, you know, 22 years or so ago. And I've been here long enough to kind of look and go, okay, why is Oregon, I don't want to say embarrassed, but why are they sheepish about sort of embracing the idea that they've got a booster that other people don't have? And I brought this up the other day, like T. Boone Pickens at Oklahoma State was often brought up as a comparison with Phil Knight. They're not even in the same stratosphere. As it pertains to billionaires. Stephen Pickens, when he died, had a net worth of like $1.3 billion. Phil Knight's at like $34 billion. I haven't checked it since yesterday, but like $34 billion. Okay. Like, these are two different animals. And I have often just said, what's wrong with him putting his son's name on Matthew Knight Arena? Like, he built the damn thing. He should put his name on it. Like, you know, he has created some advantages to Oregon. And some vision to Oregon that other people don't have. And the comment was made when the Pac-12 disintegrated and Oregon State got stuck, that Oregon would have been stuck in the same position if it weren't for Phil Knight. You would have been in the same position. So I have always just kind of been confused by, I guess, the hesitation from Oregon fans and from Oregon itself to kind of just embrace the idea that this guy has, like, openly embrace it. You know, put the swoosh out front. This guy has been a huge benefit to Oregon. And we don't do this in professional sports. If your owner can outspend other teams, or your owner is cooler than other owners, in professional sports, we celebrate it. For years, the 49ers were held up as this shining example of they take care of their players. They've got an owner who's player friendly. They were flying in a way and taking care of players at the training table in the off season in a way that others did not. And it was celebrated when Paul Allen had the highest payroll in the NBA. Man, he really wants to win. But when you do it in college athletics, people hold it up as, oh, well, yeah, they're buying players.
Is it because it is college? Is that the only reason why?
Like, I think it's, there's a hesitation now. I think eventually people will get there and they'll be like, Oregon's got the best owner in college athletics, and celebrate that. And I have noticed with Rob Mullins, the AD now at Oregon, he's been less shy than others in talking about Phil and Penny Knight. I think he sort of was pioneering the idea that, like, we should not be ashamed of the fact or hide the fact that Phil and Penny Knight have fueled a big part of this. And, you know, it's super important to kind of acknowledge that. And I would just take it head on if I were Oregon, because I have never seen the shame in having a donor that everybody else wishes they would have. Like, if Oregon State had Phil Knight in their corner in the same way, I would just say the same damn thing. Like, you know, don't be shy about the Uncle Phil comparisons or the jokes that are being made. Like, this is something that should be celebrated. And I wrote a column years ago saying that, you know, you've got to come out and acknowledge this if you're Oregon. He helped build Matthew Knight Arena, put his late son's name on the building. And I wrote a column saying, of course, that's the name that should be on that building. Phil Knight bought it. Let him put his name on it. And you know, some Oregon fans were like, no, but we don't want that perception out there that Phil is fueling everything. Guess what? He's fueling everything. And I can remember when Mario Cristobal, you know, he eventually left for Miami, but remember when Mario Cristobal was rumored to be headed to Auburn? The Auburn job was open. Cristobal's name came up. Remember what he said? I do.
Yeah, we seem to get a lot of rumors at this time of year, you know. And this is what I can say. I can say that I haven't been contacted, okay? I don't know if my agent being contacted, and I talk to him every single day. And I trust Phil Knight. I trust Rob Mullins. I trust our administration. And I trust people here at Oregon. And as you guys know, we have been working on something. When the pandemic first hit and things kind of stalled and things have picked back up.
All right. He started with Phil Knight.
Do you think it could be a fear that when Phil Knight passes that the Oregon programs won't be as good?
I just think Oregon fans were criticized, and the university got criticized by Washington and Oregon State in particular, for kind of shamed for having the booster that was buying things. Like, hey, you're only better because you're buying things.
Yeah, so like, could it just be the fear of, like, when he passes, like, the money's going to dry up, and they think, oh, well, you know, we're doing this without the Phil Knight effect. Even if Phil Knight's not here, we as an Oregon program can still be at this level.
I don't think that's it, because I think we all kind of know Phil Knight's a smart guy, and he's probably made the accommodations. I think it's just more rooted in the idea that Oregon fans didn't want the perception nationally that they hadn't worked hard and they didn't have good ideas, and they, you know, that they were built. You know, remember the Rich Brooks era? Remember Mike Bellotti era? You know, Phil wasn't pouring money hand over fist into the program then, but, you know, that came later. Let's not forget all that hard work we put in, that sweat equity that we put in. Because I think the Oregon fan was allergic to the idea that they simply showed up and Phil Knight started writing checks and they got good. And it went often, like the Uncle Phil thing. Uncle Phil kept coming up. Uncle Phil kept coming up, and I was like, I don't really see the shame in that.
Yeah, could it be? I think I come with the answer, John. I think it's that they don't want to be looked at as front runners, because there's a lot of Duck fans that are looked at as front runners because they're part of the newer generation. But you're right, like back in the '90s, the Ducks weren't this type of program.
I also think it's going to be interesting to see as minds shift, if the perception shifts with it, you know, that Oregon is just doing things better than others right now, because that's the truth. Like, and if Oregon State doesn't get smart about it, and if Oregon State wants to step back and go, okay, what can we do better? Look over at Oregon. Do what they're doing. Copy them. Copy their social media approach. Copy the fact that they've got students working on videos at games and that they use Monday and Tuesday as a big promotional opportunity. There's a lot of setup. There's a lot of thought. I think Dan Lanning's got a coach that's working with him on, you know, his branding and his image. I mean, I've seen him in 2 years kind of shift his messaging, you know, to, you know, I hear the talking points he showed up with at the Big Ten Media Day. I don't think he came up with all those on his own. I think he had help. I think Oregon's just being really smart about it. I want you to leave it here. Punch It Audio coming up, the 5 at 5, and then we go to Ohio State. We've already visited Georgia. We'll go to Bill Rabinowitz of the Columbus Dispatch in the 5 o'clock hour.
Got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I'd love to hear from our listeners. What do you think the whole Phil Knight thing is about? What's it about for you? What's it about for Duck fans? What's it about for Beaver fans? Are Oregon fans hesitant to make it all about Phil Knight because it says something about the program? If Phil Knight is just the only difference, that it feels like it was more arbitrary. Was it lucky that he was an Oregon grad and not somewhere else? I mean, you tell me what it's about. 503-417-7575. Because Oregon balances the idea that, on one hand, I think I've heard over and over again, hey, we're just grateful that we have Phil and Penny Knight. You heard Mario Cristobal's comment. Dan Lanning said a very similar thing, you know, about the relationship that he's got with Phil Knight and some of the tentacles that have come from that. You know, he's got a chance to meet Michael Jordan at the national championship game and hang out with Jordan and Derek Jeter in the Nike suite. He's got, you know, because of Phil Knight's connection, you know, Tiger Woods can send a text message. You know, Phil Knight has been around and he's been part of the success of, you know, Oregon athletics. And for a while, I've just kind of hesitated to be like, you know, well, why is that almost kept like it's a family secret, you know, and why is it handled in the way that it's handled by Oregon fans? And what, and conversely, Washington fans and probably Oregon State fans bring it up more than anybody. Like, does it feel arbitrary to you if you're an Oregon State fan or a Washington fan? Like, hey, yeah, they had Phil Knight, and that's the difference. 503-417-7575. I will bring up what Sonny Vaccaro said on this show about Phil Knight.
Well, I think he thinks with a single mind. I think everything gets a point to him and his company are the most important things, and his family, obviously, is important, but he's brilliant. There's no question about it. He's a bright man. Oh, my God. Yes, he is. I haven't seen or talked to Phil in a long time, but what he's created with the help of Jordan, with the guest star from Jordan, I have to throw that in, John. But what he's done, it's hard to maintain success. It's hard to maintain, you know, what you're going after. And he was able to do it. He is able to do it. And I'm forever, you know, I knew Howard White very, very closely during the years I worked there. So I know most of the people, you know, that were there, especially then. But, you know, he got an empire. He got what he wanted, and he got it.
Got an empire. 503-417-7575. Why is that held up as sort of a criticism of Oregon? And if you're an Oregon fan, what's with the hesitation of sort of just taking that head on? I want to know. Dan Lanning talked about the first time he met Phil Knight.
Super humbling. Just impressed with the man. You see, when you see him at first, you're in awe. You know, this is a guy that truly might be one of the most innovative. He's changed college football. He's changed sports, the sports world. But to be that impactful, but that humble at the same time is so unique. He's just a guy. He's just a guy, and he wants you to know that he's just a guy. But we all know he's so much more than a guy. Completely changed sports and the world forever in the way that he's operated.
I would just love to know from your perspective as a listener what that's about. Let's go to the phone lines. Welcome to the program. Cal and Eugene, how you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. What do you make of it?
So, I mean, obviously anyone who's not an Oregon fan is gonna want to poke fun at it, but I really don't think that anyone should, because really, if you I just watched the Rooted in Substance documentary, like the 25-minute one with Oregon and Nike basically together, and essentially Nike was born from Oregon. I mean, you have a track coach, Oregon track coach, Oregon athlete who invented the thing together. They're essentially a product of Oregon, and in a way, kind of feels like Oregon made the company. I mean, it's the same idea that, you know, no one's going to get mad at a mom who lives in a giant mansion because her son is a famous athlete and bought her the house. I think that's kind of what it's coming down to, is he's basically a son of Oregon, and it's just giving back to Oregon, and it's all kind of a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, and not one that often gets brought up. People will say, well, look how lucky Stanford is that Phil Knight got his MBA from Stanford, went to Stanford Business School. He's given them quite a bit of money as well. And look how fortunate it was for Oregon that he was a student at Oregon, forgetting that part, you know, the big piece of Phil Knight's becoming Phil Knight was because of his relationship with Bill Bowerman and the track and field mecca that Oregon was at that time. Let's go to Jeremy, who's in Eugene. I love this. We're getting calls out of Eugene. Jeremy, go ahead.
Hey, John. Lifelong Duck fan, went to the University of Oregon, and I wear it on the shoulder. He's Uncle Phil. He's affectionately known as that at the University of Oregon because, like your previous caller said, he's a son of Oregon, and they do have a symbiotic relationship where he can test out the new technologies with our football team and then take them to the masses.
I love it. I love that you said you wear it on your shoulder. And I think Oregon fans should wear it on their shoulder.
Do you think they're becoming more understandable to that, that they wanted to, that they're okay to flaunt it now, that Phil Knight is Oregon?
I think you have to be, because I think you can't hide from it in an era that openly has NIL. And maybe it was easier to kind of just like wave it off when Oregon was marketing and branding like nobody else was marketing and branding, but gosh, it looks suspiciously like Nike doing comic books. You know, they were just so far ahead of everybody else and a little edgier than everybody else with the uniforms and everything, that it was clearly Nike's influence on Oregon that was happening. And there was sort of a hesitation, I think, from Oregon fans to kind of do what Jeremy said and wear it on the right on your sleeve and put it on your shirt and stitch it in there. But I think you're right, Stephen, and I think that now that we're in an era of NIL, hell, I don't have the records for Division Street because they're not publicly accessible. But I can tell you, like, I've talked to the Cougar Collective at Washington State. I've talked frequently with Damnation Collective at Oregon State. I've talked with the Sun Angel Collective at Arizona State. I've reached out to a number of different collectives. They're really always eager to talk with me because it helps them if they're quoted. It helps them if they show up in print at johnconzano.com. It's just exposure for them. The Boulevard Collective at SMU, I talked to those honks for a long time. Those guys are like Boss Hog and petroleum, oil, money, and all that. You know, they got deep pockets, but they're still wanting to talk. The Boulevard Collective wants to talk, and they want you to know, hey, outside of Oregon, we're the top collective in the country. And I reach out to Division Street, crickets. Division Street, not interested in being quoted, not interested in being linked to, doesn't need outside help from, they're not asking Oregon grads to give $49.99 a month. Have you seen that anywhere, Stephen? Have you seen Oregon's collective Division Street put its hand out and say to Duck fans, hey, give $100 a month and help support athletes at Oregon?
I have not seen that. And don't you just think it's because no matter what they say or what they would put out, it would be spun negatively because they do have Phil Knight in the back pocket?
Maybe, but I sort of suspect that it is Phil Knight, that Division Street actually is Phil Knight, like not literally him answering the phones, but I think Division Street is sitting back going, hey, the vast majority of this money is Phil Knight's. We don't need it. We don't need help from anybody else to fund this collective. I don't think they're asking anybody to give. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you're an Oregon fan, you heard from Division Street, you got an email, you saw a billboard, said Division Street needs your help. You correct me if I'm wrong and call in, but I kind of think Division Street is going, we're good.
But would it almost be better to have an advertisement like that just to be like, look, we're not all Phil Knight. Like if Oregon fans are still that, not embarrassed, but you know, they're self-conscious about it. Is that better to do it that way?
If they're marketing to the rest of us, yes. But if they're marketing to athletes, maybe the perception that they have a whale and everybody else is a goldfish, maybe that perception is worth more.
Isn't that what Oregon's athletes want, is to be part of Nike? Like, that's why they're going to Oregon.
Maybe that's it. And it's not the charming grassroots, hey, everybody, we just beat Oregon State 31-7. Give $31.70 to the Division Street Collective to celebrate it. You're not getting that out of Oregon and Division Street. I think it's interesting. The 5 at 5 is coming up. We will have a visit from Bill Rabinowitz of the Columbus Dispatch in the 5 o'clock hour. We'll check in on Ohio State. We've already visited with Georgia. We are spanning the globe on today's show. Stick around.
From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Social media freaking out over Devin Booker and Suni Lee taking a photograph together in Paris. Hearts are being broken, Stephen. It's just a picture. They may have just run into each other. It's being fashioned as a romantic evening out.
That's true. That is true. But Devin Booker is, he's got a reputation around the NBA.
Oh, he does.
Kind of, yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, I think he dated a Kardashian for a second there.
Mm. Well, maybe Suni Lee is using him. Have we thought about that?
I have not thought about that, no.
She's 21. I think he's 26 or 27. Posed for a photo. I actually think she could do better as far as hierarchy of NBA stars.
Yeah, apparently Devin Booker was dating Kendall Jenner, but they are broken up as of April 29th.
Okay. Well, they took a picture, and everybody who's got a crush on Suni Lee is freaking out about it. We're going to do the 5 at 5. I'm going to take one more phone call on Phil Knight. Put this thing to rest. Should Oregon be wearing the friendship it has with Phil Knight as a badge of honor? I think so. But what's it really about? Gary's in Tualatin. Gary, help us out. Put this thing to rest. Final word.
Hey, John, go Ducks. Hey, did you see Cole Hawker just upset the entire world in the 1500, the Olympics? Go Ducks. Did Phil Knight do that? No. His heart did that. You can buy talent, but you can't buy heart. And that's what most of the press doesn't get, is that when you go to Eugene, it's a whole nother world. It's a big time sports town, just like Boston. There's nothing else to do there except go to Duck games and follow the Ducks. And the town just absorbs it. It's like a mecca for sports. And these kids, they become faster, stronger, bigger, and they play together like nowhere else. And yeah, it's nice to have the money, but you know, you also got to have the heart, and that's what Eugene brings to the table that nowhere else does. And most people just don't get it because they don't live down there.
Yeah, I have thought for a while that there's a bubble over Eugene, and that people in Eugene don't see Eugene as other people on the outside see it. I'm not saying if it's good or bad. I'm just saying that there's kind of a bubble. It happens with cities. Certain cities have that bubble. Now, I would not compare Eugene to Boston as a sports town, but I get the point of what Gary's saying. Is he's saying, look, in addition to the resources that are bought by Phil Knight and brought to the city and the investment in athletics that has happened at a level that was unprecedented before he started giving, and he and Penny really started giving, that there are athletes there that are working their tails off and have a lot of heart. Steve Prefontaine did not benefit from the glow of Phil Knight. You know, he brought that glow with him. But I also think, like, you can't ignore the track that you know, the 1500 runner was running on, and Phil Knight's investment at Oregon and how Nike's partnership with Oregon has helped draw those athletes to Oregon. I just think Oregon should embrace the synergy. Hey, look, we've got athletes who have great heart. We've got a great sports market in a town that is thriving and really supports the athletes. And oh, by the way, we've got a donor who gave $1 billion to the university, he and his wife, and it's a better, more competitive place because of it. I think that, to me, is the honest and candid and authentic narrative on what's happening in Eugene. But you tell me, you agree with it. 503-417-7575, or maybe you have a different take. In the meantime, the 5 at 5.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, the Denver Broncos have put out their initial depth chart. And it's an official depth chart. And Bo Nix, not the starting quarterback, not the backup quarterback. He has been named the third string quarterback behind Jarrett Stidham and Zach Wilson on the initial depth charts. Now, we've heard nothing but good things out of Denver and how Sean Payton loves Bo Nix, and Bo Nix has really controlled the offense. But, John, does this mean anything right now that, you know, we're coming up on the preseason here pretty quickly and Bo Nix is named number 3 on the depth chart behind Jarrett Stidham and Zach Wilson, when I think we all kind of thought Bo Nix was going to be the starter day one?
I think this is a Sean Payton, let's take the pressure off Bo move. Because if he puts him as the starter, now, you know, pressure's on. If he puts him as number 2, people are going, well, wait a minute. You know, why is this guy third or second? You know, I'm not going to read too much into this. Let's watch and see what happens throughout the preseason. If Nix plays better, he moves up the depth chart. But I just think this is Sean Payton being a smart, good head coach who's taking the pressure off his high pick by releasing a depth chart that says, hey, you're not first, you're not second, everybody settle down. So, won't be surprised if he starts the opener still.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think he starts the opener up in Seattle?
Ideally, like if we're talking about what's best for Bo, no. He shouldn't start until about week 5. You know, that give him a chance to get more acclimated. Give him a chance to get a look at what an NFL game looks like and what preparation looks like. Give him a couple of months in the system and then let him go. But, you know, to me, it depends on what do the Broncos need out of the early part of that season. Because if you throw him out there in week 1, you are throwing him out there with a little bit of unknown. And anybody who's been in that situation, hell, we can have Neil Lomax come back on the show and talk about it. You know, starting a game on the road as a rookie, eyes wide open. I think there's a little strategy going on here. I think Bo Nix, let's just put it this way. I think by the end of the season, Bo Nix is clearly the starter.
I think you're right. I think Nix starts week 1, but I think it's also interesting that we've talked about Sean Payton. There's a lot of pressure, I think, on him to make it work with the Broncos now that the Russell Wilson experiment did not work out great at all. Maybe he does see something in Bo Nix where he needs to say, hey, you know what, you're right. Week 5 may be the answer for Bo Nix. We're not going to throw you out there week 1 because we got to go the long game here with Bo, and you're kind of my guy. Like, we drafted you first round, 12th overall. You have to be good.
Moving on.
Number 2.
Well, Florida International, not known to have a great football team, although Mike McIntyre, head coach, former Colorado head coach, they announced today at a news conference that they will be renaming their football stadium Pitbull Stadium for the next 5 seasons. It is what is believed to be the first time an agreement between a university and a celebrity happens. Now, Pitbull is a rapper and a singer. He agreed to a 5-year deal worth $6 million. So Pitbull is going to pay the school $1.2 million annually. He has an option to extend the contract an additional 5 years, according to ESPN. It includes Pitbull's purchase of the naming rights at the stadium, the sale of Pitbull's vodka at FIU games, use of the venue for 10 days each year, an FIU anthem created by Pitbull, and the title of official entrepreneur of FIU athletics and other promotional fundraising perks. So Pitbull, he is known as Mr. 305 because of his Miami upbringing. He acknowledged that he did not attend FIU, nor did he graduate high school, but he does have ties to the school through people that he loves dearly. FIU, they will open up Pitbull Stadium September 7th against Central Michigan. So FIU getting $6 million from Pitbull to name the stadium.
I started thinking about this when I saw it. You know, what stadium should we go out and buy the naming rights for? BFT Stadium.
Well, Portland State, obviously.
Yeah, Hillsborough Stadium. Yeah. Let's do it. Yeah, we'll call it BFT Stadium from now on. It's where the Vikings play. It's not quite the same as...
Do you think that's going to happen more often now?
Yes. And I think the Snoop Dogg in the bowl game, the L.A. Bowl, Jimmy Kimmel Bowl, Snoop Dogg, all, that all kind of started, I think, a wave. And I think what part of it is I think naming rights fees have dropped. And so it's opening up naming rights to new, more creative areas. And I think celebrity endorsement in the naming rights space is not a bad way to go. And we'll find out if that works out for Pitbull and FIU.
Number three.
We could see history tonight in Major League Baseball as the Chicago White Sox have lost 21 games in a row, which ties the AL record for most losses in a row after their loss last night to the A's. Their manager, Pedro Grifol, he said, "We talk about it every day. Everybody knows what it is. It's 21 in a row. It sucks. It's not fun. It's painful. It hurts. You name it, however you want to describe it." The White Sox, they're 0-17 since the All-Star break. This is the longest losing streak since the Baltimore Orioles opened the season in 1988 with 21 straight losses. They now trail only the Philadelphia Phillies, who set the modern-day record with 23 straight losses in 1961. But they already tied for the American League record. Looks like they can set the record tonight. They go up against the A's. If they lose, it'd be 22 in a row, but not great baseball. Chicago White Sox history, though.
Do you root for it, or do you root against it?
Well, you root against it, don't you? Or you root for it? You root them to lose.
I don't know. Do you? Like,
I do.
I don't. You know, the White Sox are closing in on this thing. I read a story in the Philadelphia Inquirer because the 1961 Phillies, as you mentioned, had that record, and they asked, you know, how was it? And the guy said, "Have you ever been booed by 30,000 people?"
I found this stat for the White Sox. If you eliminate their 14-game losing streak they had earlier in the year and the 21-game losing streak they have now, their winning percentage would still be lowest in the major leagues. So if you eliminate 35 losses, they would still be the worst team in baseball.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the 61 Phillies lost 107 games, okay? The White Sox are on pace to lose 123. It's not even close. It's a worse team. But... you know, when you get into a losing thing and a losing trend or a losing streak, just things start to cave in on you. And think about 1961, right? Roger Maris was chasing Babe Ruth's home run record. And, you know, all this great stuff was going on in baseball. And the Phillies in the background of it were setting a record for the worst record in baseball history. I guess people in Philadelphia are rooting for it. They're rooting for the White Sox to lose because they want it to be done.
You think
done.
They get it tonight against the A's? They set the American League record? I think they do.
The A's will blow it. The A's, come on. Well, we'll see what happens. I'm going to root against it. I want 1961 to stand. So I'll root for the Phillies tonight, or the White Sox tonight. We'll see.
Number four.
We got a couple food stories to wrap it up here. Adam Peaty, he won a silver medal in the 100-meter breaststroke at the Paris Games this year. He had an interview with a British newspaper, and he was hating on the food that they had at the Olympic Village. Peaty said, "I like my fish, and people are finding worms in the fish. It's just not good enough. The standard we're looking at is the best of the best, and we're feeding them not the best." Peaty did not provide a picture or anything like that. But he did say that there was worms in the food. That is not all, of course. Paris has pledged to make 60% of all their meals meatless in order to reduce their carbon footprint, which Petey was not happy as well, because he eats a lot of meat as he is a swimmer, needs his endurance. He said the narrative of sustainability has just been punished on the athletes. "I want to eat meat. I need to eat meat to perform. That's what I eat at home, so why should I change?" He said Tokyo, the food was incredible. Rio was incredible. This time around, there wasn't enough protein options. Now, the company that provided the food, they had told TMZ that this is BS, that there was no worms in their fish, then it's just a false claim. There's been zero proof, they say. The company also said the Great Britain team confirmed they haven't received any complaints about the food. Sudoku Live was named an official partner of the Olympics. They say they're making about 40,000 meals a day for 15,000 athletes at both the Olympic and Paralympic Games, but... worms, maybe not worms, at the Olympic Village and their fish.
I'm thinking The mattresses are bad. The food is bad. They're not going to get a good Yelp review on this Olympics. It's gonna be a bad review.
No tip left on the nightstand there.
Well, then you also saw a couple of American athletes who were not staying in the Olympic Village alongside other athletes that literally were saying, hey, we're not going to leave this to anybody else. I'm going to control where I sleep. I'm going to control what I eat. I don't want to be around a bunch of yahoos who are in there to party.
But isn't that important now? Because we know the science behind the importance of food.
100%.
Like, 100%. We need to have this better accommodations for these athletes and the best in the world.
But the athletes who didn't stay in the village had a hard time, too, like getting into like the training competitions and the venues. They had to be dropped away blocks away. They got, you know, Sha'Carri Richardson, there was a video of her. She was trying to get into the warm-up area for track and field. And since she didn't ride the athlete bus into the area, there was a big, there's a big blow up over getting her in there. I kind of think you're going to see some countries who go, yeah, we're going to pass and we're going to rent an apartment building and put our athletes in that apartment.
When it's down in L.A. in 4 years, then they want some meat. Get like Killer Burger down there. Give them some real, real good meat there.
I like that idea. Killer Burger.
Number five.
And one more food story to wrap it up here. The Cardinals, Arizona Cardinals in the NFL, have been really bad the last couple of years. So they're trying something new this year. They are going to be serving, wait for this, John, a cotton candy burrito. There was reporters in there looking at the new food options, and there was a sign and a cotton candy burrito, which says it contains ice cream and candy wrapped in cotton candy. And a look inside of it confirmed it as they did cut into one. It's sugar wrapped in sugar and has a combination of ice cream. To me, it looked like inside was a little bit of Fruit Loops, sprinkles, M&Ms, and some other candies. I couldn't really tell. There's also some like chocolate sauce based as the salsa, but it looks like it's a cavity on a plate. Cotton candy burrito. Are you in? Are you trying that when you go down to Arizona?
No, I'm not having a cotton candy burrito. That's mixing things that don't go together. No thanks. Pass on that.
Have you ever eaten like anything crazy at one of the stadium of the ballparks? Like I had the cockroaches or whatever at the Mariner game one time.
My kids love to get Salt and Straw, the ice cream. And they had that ice cream. It was right around Halloween, and it had crickets in it.
Yeah, the crickets
in the ice cream. That's yeah,
yeah.
Nuh-uh. Not for me. I'm not big on eating bugs. Okay, insects, no. Although, you know, if I were in the wilderness and starving, I probably would. Okay,
you just want the regular meat sauce and meatballs, spaghetti and meatballs there.
Yes, I like to say to my kids who, if they're not eating their broccoli or whatever's on their plate, I go, you're not hungry enough. So there comes a point when you are hungry enough to eat an insect. So there's
I would give it a shot. A cotton candy burrito. I wouldn't want to eat the whole thing. It was pretty large. Like, it was like the size of my head, the one that they showed. I wouldn't eat that one, but I would give it a bite. I'd try it.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say pass on that. But, you know, you always go to countries, and you're in strange countries, and they have, like, foods. Like, there's the night market in China or whatever, and they'll be serving, like, scorpion and other things that I can't even talk about on air. And then you find out, like, Anna speaks Mandarin, and, you know, she's born in Taiwan. And so we were at the night market in Beijing, and they were serving all these exotic foods. And she's asking the vendors, do you eat this? And the vendors are going, hell no. I don't eat this. It's for the tourists. So they're just feeding the tourists, like, scorpion and, you know, all these sea slugs and all this exotic food.
So they make you think it's a delicacy, and it's just what they found in their apartment.
They had, like, how do I put this? They had the genitalia of animals that they were serving, like, on a stick. And I was like, no. Like, I'm not that hungry, you know? I'm not going to, not doing that.
I like to try those kind of things. I mean, I haven't tried a bunch of them, but I would definitely try a lot of different things, I feel like.
Here's another thing, too, because in China at the Beijing Olympics in 2008, I've talked about this before, but, you know, in America, they gouge you at the stadium, most stadiums. I'll say, like, there's certain owners, like the Atlanta Falcons have decided they're still going to serve, like, a $2 hot dog, and they're going to serve a soda at a reasonable price. They're not gouging their fans. Like, some stadiums have decided, very few of them have decided, we're going to really take care of our fans. And the fans appreciate that, because then they go to the game, and they'll eat at the game, right? Well, in Beijing, it hit me almost immediately, because I'm at these venues, and you get dropped off there as a media member by the media shuttle, and then there's no media dining area at these venues. You just have to kind of eat the concessions like everybody else. And, you know, there's dining back at the main press center, the MPC, as they call it. But you get out to the venues and you are at the mercy of what they have at the concession stand. And the Chinese people did not understand concessions. It was wild. So you go to these Olympic venues and they would have like a cup of noodles and they would have like a soda. And then they would serve a hot dog, but with no bun. It was just a hot dog on a stick. It was like the hot dog itself on a stick. And then the prices, Stephen, were just normal prices. They weren't gouging anybody. And so I was like, I was trying to tell them, like, you guys are missing it here. You make this hot dog, you put a bun on it, and you serve it for $12, and people will buy it. And you can serve, you can sell an ice cream sandwich for $6, you know, and they were looking at me like I was crazy. But the Chinese people who were the fans who were going to the games, they didn't get it either. Nobody was eating. They didn't come to the stadium to eat the food. They came to watch the game.
Which is
it's
crazy.
Just a different culture.
It's just crazy because I love to go to the stadium to eat some food. You're right about Mercedes-Benz in Atlanta. Mark Raimondi is a beat writer. He sent out a picture a couple days ago. He said this buys you $20 of food there. It was a popcorn, a hot dog, pretzel, nachos, chicken tenders and fries, pizza and a drink, all for $20.
Yep.
It's like, they, do that in Portland, please.
I saw Arthur Blank, the owner of the Falcons, quoted, and he said, we're charging enough for the tickets, and we're not going to gouge you. And I think that goes a long way with the fan base, and the Blazers should try that.
I mean,
the Ducks
good,
and the Beavers should try it.
Get some good PR, at least, you know?
And I think it makes people want to eat at the game. Because what do I hear from Blazer fans? You know, there's no real food options around Moda Center, right? So Blazer fans have to make a decision. Either I'm eating somewhere else entirely, or I'm eating at the arena. And I just think if you gave fans a reasonably priced hot dog, soda, slice of pizza, you'd have families that went, you know what, let's just go to the arena early, and we'll eat there. But instead, you have people go, we have to stop somewhere on the way to the game. And I think it's a conscious thing that has to happen. Bill Rabinowitz of the Columbus Dispatch is coming up. We're going to talk Ohio State. We talked earlier in the show with Chip Towers of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about number one, Georgia. We go to number two, Ohio State, next.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We are spanning the globe today. And this radio show truly is statewide now. Want to thank 92.5 The Ticket in Bend for coming onto the network. They join the Ace in Medford. We're really excited about Medford coming on the BFT radio network, along with Klamath Falls and Roseburg and Eugene and Portland, of course. But Medford, special place in my heart. My mother-in-law lives there. She can now listen to the show while she's driving around and running her errands. She can tune in, and when Anna does the 5 at 5, she can laugh at how Anna gives me a hard time, and really excited to have that. So shout out to Eagle Point, Oregon, and Medford and Ashland and all of Southern Oregon who are now listening on the network on the Ace. We're going now to Columbus, Ohio. Bill Rabinowitz, he covers the number two team in the coaches poll, Ohio State. Nobody better on that beat. He's joining us now. Hey, Bill, how you doing, man?
Good, John. How are you?
I am well. It is date night tonight for you and your household. You're going to dinner. Give us an idea in Columbus. What's a night on the town look like?
Well, we already had it. You know, we're 3 hours ahead of you.
Oh, that's
so
right.
I met my wife. This is funny. There's a Mexican place. Right down the street from us. I mean, we're driving there, and I was like, we should have just walked, but it was really hot. And we were running a little late. So, I mean, literally, it's like 0.3 miles from our house. So we really felt pathetic going there. But I met my son and his girlfriend and my niece and nephew and their little kids, so we had a nice little dinner.
I love that. You know, I grew up with family dinners. I think that's important stuff, and it's great that you get together and your kid gets together with. Is your kid living in Columbus too?
Yeah. One of them does. The other lives in Oakland, California. So it'll be nice when I come out for the game. I will take a long week of it and fly from Portland to Oakland and see her for a few days before flying back to Columbus. So another reason I'm looking forward to that weekend.
Good for you, Bill Rabinowitz, with us, Columbus Dispatch. 25 years at the Columbus Dispatch. Nobody better on Ohio State. And Bill, the coaches poll comes out. Ohio State's at 2. That's not a surprise. But how is that sort of going over with Ohio State coaches, players, and fans?
You know, it's funny. I never really presumed to know that answer. Well, I can say for the coaches, the players, they don't really care because they've got their work ahead of them. They're in Rebels training camp. They don't, you know, the polls are the last thing on their mind. You know, the fan base, they're probably fine with it. I mean, Georgia is Georgia, and they return their quarterback, and obviously it's a really good team. I was a little bit surprised that the Ohio State didn't get more first-place votes. I thought it'd be a closer kind of point battle between Ohio State and Georgia, but it doesn't really matter. Especially this year, it mattered less than ever because you got 12 teams in it. And it's going to be a whole different kind of feel for the season. I mean, even like the Ohio State-Oregon game, which in any other year until now would have been like, oh, my God, they have to win. And now it's like, well, it'll be nice to win, but it's not like it's a mortal wound if they don't.
The Big Ten Conference media days were interesting to me. So many teams, such a big conference. And now, you know, you always had Michigan and Ohio State. Now Oregon and USC come into the room. But, you know, we had Michigan's beat reporter Austin Meek for The Athletic on the show last week, and he said Michigan fans are focused on Ohio State. What are Ohio State fans focused on?
Well, they'll be focused on Michigan because that's the rivalry. And unless you're in Ohio or Michigan, I don't think you really quite understand the passion that people have for that rivalry. I mean, I know Oregon State, you know, that was a big deal, obviously. But Ohio State, Michigan, it's gone on forever. And now in recent years, you have the bad blood between Harbaugh and Ryan Day and the cheating scandal that, you know, a lot of Ohio State fans think those three wins over Ohio State, at least the first two, were illegitimate because Michigan was, you know, apparently cheating. We'll know more about exactly what happened, hopefully down the road. But there is that sense that was not a fair fight. And so that's always going to be the rivalry. But in terms of Ohio State and Oregon, I think there's a lot of respect by Ohio State fans. Oregon's obviously a really good team. And there's a lot of anticipation about the game in Eugene, a lot of excitement about that game. There's a history between Ohio State and Oregon. Of course, 10 years ago, Ohio State beat Oregon to win the national title. And then a few years ago, 3 years ago, I guess it was, Oregon came to Columbus and beat the Buckeyes. And that was a game that really exposed Ohio State's defense. And that was kind of a transformative game for Ohio State. Just a little tidbit I might want to share is I did a story on Ryan Day's relationship with Chip Kelly. And in the course of doing the interviews, I found out that Ryan Day was almost hired instead of Bart Helfrich by Chip Kelly. He wanted to hire Ryan Day. Ryan Day was close to accepting it, but he had a very young family. His three kids were really young. He didn't want to move across the country and all of the family back in New Hampshire. And so at the last minute, he turned it down. And Day said, did you ever think, that could have been you on the sideline instead of Mark Helfrich coaching against Ohio State? He said, oh, yeah. So just think about that, maybe it would have been a different outcome. Who knows?
Yeah, Ryan Day might still be the coach at Oregon, and we never heard of Willie Taggart, Mario Cristobal, and Dan Lanning.
Right,
we're talking to Bill Rabinowitz. How is the Chip Kelly arrival gone over? You've had a little bit of a chance to talk with him and be around him. How is he fitting?
Yeah, I kind of heard these stories before. He was very quirky and kind of, I don't want to say standoffish, but just kind of like, just kind of difficult to deal with. I found him to be in the conversations that I've had with him to be perfectly fine. I had a half hour conversation with him for that story on his relationship with Ryan. And obviously that's a story he's happy to tell, but just in kind of casual conversations with him, he's very loose. He's very happy. I think he just likes being a football coach, not dealing with the other stuff you got to deal with as a head coach and, all that stuff. I just think he likes coaching football, and here he can do it with his protege, and I think he's just having a ball.
Yeah, and I think, that when he left UCLA, Bill, he texted with me, and we texted about his happiness, and he alluded to the fact that he just wanted to be happy, and I think he gets a chance to coach, and he doesn't have to deal with the head coaching stuff at Ohio State. And I wouldn't be surprised if Chip Kelly never wanted to be a head coach again. I think he wants to teach and he wants to coach and wants to be happy. And that two-headed monster, though, Ryan Day and Chip Kelly, I could see that being problems for people. I mean, that is an elite offensive attack. How is the defense coming together at Ohio State?
Well, the defense is really, really good. I mean, we do that because they returned almost everybody from that defense last year. I mean, we lost a few players, but they returned almost everybody, and they got Caleb Downs from Alabama, who might be the single best player on the team. But he's that good. And I mean, we got to watch the first 4 days of practice, and it was really hard for the offense to do a whole lot. It was a lot of checkdowns, very few passes that were deep or even medium length down the field that were completed. It's a really, really good defense. I mean, you know, I think teams like Oregon will obviously challenge them, but I think about some of the weaker Big Ten teams, and if you're like, how are they going to get a first down? I mean, it's all, are they going to cross midfield? I mean, it's like that kind of thing. And I don't know that they've got somebody who's like a Bosa or a Chase Young or somebody who's just going to be a top five draft pick. But they got a bunch of guys who could be first round draft picks. I mean, Jack Sawyer, JT Tuimoloau, Denzel Burke at cornerback, Sonny Styles at linebacker, again, Caleb Downs. I mean, they're just loaded. They don't have a weakness on that defense. And obviously injuries could change things, and you could have a bad game and have breakdowns and somebody, you know, scores on you. But boy, oh boy, on paper and what I've seen so far in training camp, they're going to be really, really good.
Give me an idea, the depth of the Big Ten, because you kind of hit on it there. And I was thinking about it as 18 teams showed up in Indianapolis and talked about their season. How many teams with a straight face, Bill, do you think can reasonably talk about contending for a championship in the Big Ten?
It's Ohio State, Oregon, Michigan. I would say most years USC. I don't know that I would say that this year. In fact, I think I would not say that this year. But, you know, I think if Luke Fickell can get it going at Wisconsin, I think they've got the foundation, the program history, and the desire to be a contender. I think Michigan State's got a long way to go, but Jonathan Smith's a really good coach, and he could get them there at some point. You know, Washington is obviously a very good program. They lost, I mean, literally almost everybody from that team, so they're a mystery. And obviously Penn State is a really good program, but Penn State has been very good, but even in James Franklin's words, not elite. And so, you know, it's Ohio State and Oregon and Michigan that I'd say, you know, every year, and USC I would say most years, you know, and I think that Lincoln Riley will get that going, or should at least. So I think it's those four, and then maybe Penn State. But, you know, you look at some of these other teams, and they had the benefit of being in the West Division for all those years, so at least they could get to the Big Ten Championship game. They never won one. No West team won a Big Ten Championship. But they could at least get there. Now you think of a team like, you know, Minnesota or Northwestern or Indiana, Purdue. I mean, what chance do they have to ever win a Big Ten Championship? I don't think they do. Iowa was a team I didn't mention. But at least on one side of the ball, they're championship caliber. I mean, their defense is always really good. Phil Parker's an absolutely phenomenal defensive coordinator. But their offense has just been dreadful. They finally made some coaching changes, got rid of Ferentz's son. So maybe there's hope for them down the road. But, you know, I think Iowa's a middle-of-the-back team most years.
I want to talk about Michigan for a second. And Jim Harbaugh, in the wake of the news and the NCAA's investigation, he is adamant that he didn't know.
Never lie, never cheat, never steal. I was raised with that lesson. I have raised my family on that lesson. I have preached that lesson to the teams that I've coached. No one's perfect. If you stumble, you apologize, and you make it right. Today, I do not apologize. I did not participate, was not aware, nor complicit in those said allegations. So for me, it's back to work and attacking with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind.
How did that go over with Ohio State's fans?
I tweeted that just because it was kind of like setting the fuse and just saying, okay, let's see how this blows up. And right. It was predictable results. You know, the Pinocchio comments and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Look, you know, I can't get inside Jim Harbaugh's brain. I obviously don't know what he knew. But it is, is it plausible that a low-level guy making, you know, $50,000 or whatever it was is the mastermind of this scheme? I mean, you know, I'm not saying Jim Harbaugh is the one who knew, but I don't think he was a rogue guy who just said, you know, I think it might be fun to steal people's signs, and I'm just going to do it, not tell anybody above me. I just find that hard to believe.
I just,
but I'm not going to, I can't assign blame or, you know, say who actually did direct it. I have no idea.
But you and I have been in this business 3 decades each, right? And we can look at this, and we, I know head football coaches have their finger on everything. And if they don't, it's their director of operations who's, I mean, every detail of the program is buttoned up. I have a hard time, let's just talk it in general terms, because we don't want to, you know, implicate Jim Harbaugh, but I have a hard time believing that a coach would have something like this going on and not know about it.
They are all control freaks. They all want to know everything that happens in their program. They get upset when they don't know the smallest detail of whatever happened. And so, yes, it kind of, it's highly questionable that something, that a scheme like that, that involves travel, involves buying tickets, involves, you know, whatever it involved, that people above him didn't know. I mean, including the head coach. Now, do I know? Of course I don't know that. Jim Harbaugh might be telling the truth. I'm not going to disparage him and say he's a liar. I don't know that. But like you said, we've been in this business a long time. We know how coaches want to know everything. And it's like, really? Right? Really?
Yeah. Bill Rabinowitz, Columbus Dispatch with us. October 12th, you'll be at Autzen Stadium watching Ohio State, Oregon. How much does the last Ohio State, Oregon game stick it in the craw of that program? Does it even factor? What concerns, if any, does Ohio State have entering the season? Let's talk October 12th.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm looking forward to it. We were supposed to go to Autzen in 2020, and of course the pandemic wiped that out, so I was disappointed. Oregon's one of the, I don't know, a handful of states I've not been to, and one of the few of those that I actually want to go to. So I am looking forward to going to Oregon. I hear it's a great atmosphere. You know, it's about half the size of Ohio Stadium, which is, you know, over 100,000, but I hear it's a great atmosphere. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, it'll be fun, actually. You know, it makes no difference to me, but, you know, like I said earlier, the game is important, but it's not everything. So it's going to be more fun than it is people, like, you know, being panicked if their team loses, because there is life after that game. I think it'll be a great challenge. I think about Dylan Gabriel, and I talked to him at the Big Ten Media Days. Very impressive guy. Very likable. Presents himself very well. Very well spoken. I know he's a terrific quarterback. So nothing but nice things to say about Dylan Gabriel and my interactions with him in Indianapolis. You know, that's going to be obviously a challenge for Ohio State's defense. By far the biggest challenge they will have had to that point, and probably the biggest challenge we'll have all season, to be honest. At least until the playoffs. I don't know that much about Oregon's defense, to be honest. So, you know, we'll see what Ohio State's offense looks like. I mean, I think that Will Howard will be the quarterback, but Chip Kelly said today there's no front runner. I mean, I think there is, and I think it's Will Howard, but he's not going to say that. Ohio State has two great running backs, Travion Henderson and Quinshon Judkins, the transfer from Ole Miss. They've got elite receivers. The offensive line should be considerably better than it was last year just by having experience. You know, they got Marvin Harrison Jr., obviously, and that's a big loss, but they do reload and not just rebuild at Ohio State. So I think it'll be a fascinating game. I think it's, other than the Ohio State Michigan game, for reasons I've already talked about, it's the game of the year in the Big Ten. And so it's going to be fun to go cover that one.
Bill Rabinowitz, Columbus Dispatch. Let's connect before you come out. Love to say hello, and thank you for giving us some of your time, Bill.
Always happy to be on with you, John.
There he goes. We've gone now to Athens, Georgia, where we checked in with Chip Towers of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, number one team in the country. We have now gone to Columbus, Ohio, with Bill Rabinowitz, the number two team in the coaches' poll. Shall we just keep going? Shall you know, Oregon's three. We had a visit earlier this week, yesterday, with Stephen Woodward at Fox Sports Eugene. So we've been to Eugene. Should we go to Austin, Texas next? Number four, Texas, and then Alabama? Should we just go down the list, Stephen, spanning the globe? Ole Miss, Notre Dame, Michigan, Penn State?
I don't hate it because I'm getting excited for college football. I'll tell you what.
Missouri at 11, LSU at 12. Tell me when you lose interest. Salt Lake City, 13. Clemson, 14. Spanning the globe.
I'm in.
Tennessee, Oklahoma, Kansas State, Oklahoma State, Miami. Mario Cristobal, we'll get him on. Number 19, Miami. And I'm looking at the poll, by the way. Let's see, a couple things jumped out at me. I think Georgia's on another level. And so I do think Georgia's going to stick at one and be at one for a while. I think Alabama at five is overrated. I think Texas at four might be overrated. I like Ole Miss a little better. I think Michigan's too high at eight. They got a first place vote. I think Miami at 19 is too low. I think Utah at 13 is too low. I think Utah's going to end up in the top eight. Keep an eye on it. And I'm still looking for a group of five here.
You got to replace those teams, though. I mean, you're saying these teams are overrated. You got Utah jumping up. Who else are you jumping up and over Michigan? Or Texas or Alabama.
I'm dropping Michigan. I'm dropping Texas. I'm dropping Alabama. I'm raising Utah up in the top eight. I don't think Notre Dame should be at seven either. I think they're lower. So I think Penn State will be up higher. I think Florida State and Utah will be up higher. And Miami. And I think Miami's going to be a top 10 team.
That's a nice pick right there. Nice sleeper pick.
I just think, you know how it goes. Oh, people fill out these coaches are filling out the ballots and they're going Georgia, Ohio State, Oregon, Texas, Alabama. Wake me up. Like, you know,
Texas A&M's in there.
You know, they're just filling out their ballots and they're just going, I got to get this over with. But, you know, USC at 23. Interesting. Let's play a game in the next segment. Underrated or overrated? Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750, The Game.
Overrated or underrated? We're going to play that game in this segment. It's going to be fast moving. I hope you can keep up. Stephen Bourne, let's play it together. Fireworks, underrated or overrated?
Oh, overrated. One more overrated things in the world.
Disagree with you. I think they're underrated, especially if it's you setting them off. I think they're exciting. Yes, they're overpriced, but I don't think they're overrated. Let's pivot to college football. Georgia at number one in the coaches poll preseason top 25 rankings. They got 46 of the first place votes. Ohio State got seven. Texas and Michigan getting one apiece. Georgia, overrated, underrated?
They're properly rated at first place. I think that's really exactly what it should be.
47 out of the last 49 games they've won. That's incredible. They deserve to be one. Let's look at Ohio State at two. Are they where they should be?
They are. I think you could argue them as number one as well, but I would give it to Georgia. I think Ohio State is number two, though. I think it's perfect.
I think Georgia's head and shoulders better than Ohio State. I'd put them ahead and shoulders in front of them, but I like where Ohio State is. How about Oregon at three? I want to say Oregon at three might be a touch overrated, but I'm struggling with who do I put in front of them, so I'll say they're about where they should be.
I agree, because I had the same thought, too. I thought, well, maybe four, but I don't know who I'm going to put in front of them. So, yeah, I think if I'm doing my rankings, I would have Oregon at number three. So, yeah, I think it's perfect there, too.
Interesting to see Oregon. You know, as Dan Lanning said, the rabbit has the gun right now. Barbershop quartets, underrated or overrated?
Overrated.
Agree. Don't need it. I've never said, hey, let's go hear a barbershop quartet.
Yeah.
Texas at number four. Underrated, overrated?
I'm going to go with overrated. I would have them below. I think I'd have them below Alabama, and I think I'd have them probably not below Ole Miss, but I am interested to see how they do in the SEC year one. I think that's going to be a big transition.
I think Ole Miss is in front of Texas and Alabama. I think they're going to be better. And then I think some teams down below that are even in the double digits might end up in front of Texas and Alabama. I have some questions about Texas and Alabama. And Alabama in particular, I just think first-year head coach transition stuff tends to result in losing a game you shouldn't lose. Now, Kalen DeBoer at Alabama, he's got a lot of proof of performance, but I think Alabama will lose one in there, and maybe, you know, they still have a nice season, but I could see Alabama being like the 9, 10, 11 team in the college football playoff. I'm not even sure that they'll win a playoff game, but I think it'll still be a nice season by a first-year head coach standards, but the Alabama fans are not going to be happy. Laser tag, underrated or overrated?
Overrated. I feel like I'm a big target, I feel like, and then I feel like I shoot these other people and they don't count my shots, so I'm going to overrate it.
Notre Dame at 7. Underrated or overrated?
Overrated, as always. They do have Riley Leonard, transfer quarterback from Duke, but I think I would take a lot of teams below them before I take Notre Dame. They just get the benefit of being the independent.
They're a brand, and I think the coaches are going to go, okay, I'm going to put brands here. You think about who the coaches voted for high in this poll, whole bunch of brands. Anybody in the top 25, like I think Utah at 13 is a top 9 or 10 team. I think Miami at 19 is going to be a top 10 team. I think those two are underrated. Anybody jump out at you as underrated?
I think USC potentially for me is underrated. I think at 23, I think they could be higher than that. I think Oklahoma is overrated. And I think, where's the other team? Oklahoma State. I think both Oklahoma teams are overrated.
Well, if Oklahoma and Oklahoma State are overrated, Arizona at 21, I think we'll flirt with a playoff berth, but not get one.
NC State is a team to watch in the ACC as well. I think they're a little underrated.
Keep an eye on it. Expanded playoff. There'll be 12 teams this year in the playoff. All right. Appreciate everybody who made this radio show part of their day. Welcome to the network. Bend, Oregon, 92.5, The Ticket. Welcome. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.